Senate Human Services Committee together. This is an organizational meeting, and we will approve the rules before we move on. We do have a copy of the rules, and everyone has had a chance to either look at them or hear them read a number of times. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Human Services Committee rules as written.
Okay. Any objection? Hearing no objection, rules have been adopted. This is our first committee meeting. I'm Senator Bill Morissette. I'm from Senate District 6. I live in Springfield. My district includes parts of Lane County, actually urban Lane County and rural Linn County. I've served on the health committee, a health committee, since I came to the legislature in 1999. I chaired a committee last session called the Health Policy Committee, and this session I'm chairing the Human Services Committee. I'm extremely happy to be here and be chairing this committee because we have, I think, some very exciting things to do. And I would like to take a minute to just go down the line and have everybody give a brief history of their involvement in the legislature.
I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson from Gresham, and I represent Troutdale and Wood Village, Fairview, as well as Gresham. I've been in the legislature since 2001, and serving on health committee both sessions, and I'm looking forward to being on this committee, and I'm chairing the health policy. And just to let you all know, there's going to be some crossover between this committee and my health policy committee, but Senator Morissette and I get along very well, and we don't have ownership to anything.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Charles Starr, representing Senate District 13, Sherwood and Washington County, Newburgh and Yamhill County, Wilsonville and Clackamas County, St. Paul and Kaiser and Marion County. I've been here now 12 years, House and Senate, and I served several sessions on human services. Look forward to this time around.
And I'm Rick Metzger, and I represent East Clackamas County, Hood River County, small part of East Multnomah County. And admittedly, Mr. Chair, this is probably one topic which I know extremely little about, and we'll admit that. So, your leadership is important. Other than in my district, every time you read the paper about human services, they're all from my district, whether it's Sandy, Estacada, rural Oregon City. And so I'm very interested in it, and we'll look forward to all of your collective expertise to help write on the blank chalkboard here.
Good. Thank you. Well, my new experience... yes, I'm sorry. Senator Cruz is sick. He left yesterday for his home in Roseburg, and we hope that he will be back soon, but he isn't feeling well, and he is under the care of a doctor, so it's somewhat serious, but I'm sure he's not extremely serious, but he's sick enough to be away. Okay. I was going to say, new experiences, it's always interesting to be on a brand new committee, and my new experience is the Subcommittee of Ways and Means for the General Government Committee, which is a really new experience, but it's always stimulating to get involved in something that you haven't been intimately familiar with, so Rick, I'm sure that you will enjoy this. I'd like to say just a minute about, or take just a few minutes to talk about the scope of the committee. It's true that we will receive, we're not sure which bills we will be receiving as they are referred to us by the President's office. We do have some areas that we will be covering, and the area that we will cover is we're starting with rural health and the ramifications. Now, I think Senator Moniz Anderson is interested in the rural health workforce, and whether or not she hears bills on that or they're incorporated into this committee, I'm not sure. We will also be dealing with prescription drugs. Now, last session we did pass a bill, 875, which instituted a bulk purchasing program for pharmaceuticals, and we're going to work on that again. That's under the department of Bruce Goldberg, or Bruce's department, and we do have an administrator that's been hired to oversee that program, and as it evolves, and it needs a lot of evolving before it becomes a stable program, but that's will be a big issue. Long-term care, practically all of the aspects of long-term care, and there are several, and I should say many, and we will deal with several very important ones in long-term care. Services of children and family, follow-up of the quality of fully capitated health plans. That means we will be looking at some of the local county or regional agencies that deliver services under the health plan, durable goods and services, and there has been some concern about the delivery pattern. There have been some investigations and so on, and we will be looking at the various entities around the state that are charged with delivering those services. So those are some of the things we'll be looking at, and obviously bills will come to us that we have not mentioned, that we're not even aware of, and then there will be the agency bills that will be divided among the agencies. But today we are going to start with a discussion. This is invited testimony. Overview of rural health issues. This is the first hearing that we will have on this, and we will start with Karen Whitaker from OHSU Center for Rural Health. Karen, are you ready? Okay, so we are gaveling in the informational meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me here today. We're certainly pleased that you're beginning the business of your committee with a discussion of rural health care. And for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the Vice Provost for Rural Health at OHSU and the Director of the Center for Rural Health, which includes the State Office of Rural Health that is a state agency. So we do have a number of legislative work to do, legislative mandates and statutory mandates as the State Office of Rural Health. And we have been at OHSU since 1989, but the Office of Rural Health itself was established in 1979, so last year we celebrated our 25th year. So I have titled...
Could you explain why you went to OHSU in 1989 after it was established in 1979?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when the office was first established, it was part of the State Department of Human Resources, now Human Services, and it was part of a state health planning and development agency, which was primarily federally supported. That office, that federal... money went away in 1987, and the federal congressional mandates were repealed. And so the agency shifted into a different direction. It became more of a regulatory agency, and the State Office of Rural Health was really established as an advocate for rural providers and rural communities, and the two missions just didn't seem to work together well anymore. About the same time, Dr. Peter Kohler arrived at OHSU, and part of his big mission for the university was to turn it into a statewide institution. And so it looked as though that would be a very ideal place for the State Office of Rural Health, and in fact, that has proved to be so.
Good. Thank you for that background.
So I thought I would start with talking to you a bit about what is actually rural in Oregon, and this map, all of the green part of this map is rural. The only parts that are urban by our state definition are the gold parts, really right up and down the I-5 corridor, And then the only exception to that is the city of Bend in Deschutes County. So about 91% of the state's land mass is actually rural, and it works out to be, here are the counties that are rural. Their red county is the urban county. Those bright blue counties are what we call frontier counties. That's a federal definition that is six or fewer people per square mile. And in fact, some of those counties like Malheur and Harney County have less than one person per square mile. The lighter green are the counties that are, all of the cities or towns in that county are rural. And the gold counties are those that have mixed urban and rural populations. And here's how the population works out in Oregon. Only about 3% of the people live in those frontier counties, about 23% in the exclusively rural counties, and 54% of the population in the counties that have mixed urban and rural population. And then about 20% of the population of the state lives in Multnomah County. And there is actually no part of Multnomah County that meets the definition of rural. Some of the things that are different about the rural part of the state in regards to their health care and that make rural health a challenging issue is some of those things are demographics. There are some different mixtures of population and different demographic characteristics in rural Oregon. Some of that leads to health status differences. The infrastructure for healthcare in rural Oregon is fragile, and that includes the clinics, the physician's offices, and the hospitals in particular. And we have shortages of providers chronically in rural Oregon. To look at the demographic issues, there are significantly more people in rural Oregon who are elderly. If we look at the frontier counties, about 17-18% are elderly, and then we get down to the urban county, and it's about urban county, Multnomah County, it's about 12%. The unemployment rates in rural counties are also a challenge. Some of the rural counties, even throughout the 90s, when the rest of the state was recovering from the recessions of the 80s, never did leave double-digit unemployment. They didn't partake in the recovery that took place in the 90s, and then, of course, they've been harder hit as time goes by. The median income is about what you would expect, given that the unemployment rate has been higher. It's lowest in frontier counties, a little higher in rural counties, and a little higher yet in those that have mixed urban and rural populations. This map, and I apologize on the handout that you have if you're trying to follow along. Some of the maps didn't print, and I think my file was just too big. I just got too greedy with the maps, and so I'm not sure if this one printed on your handout or not. This is the data. These are the data from 2002, and those of you who read the Oregonian this morning know that a new report has been issued, and it shows an even more dire picture than we had in 2002. But basically, the darker the color here, the higher the rate of uninsurance. And we found out this morning from the latest data that in those top corner, in the far eastern counties in the corner of the state, Wallowa, Baker, Hughes Grant, and Malheur. Thank you, Bruce. Yeah, that's Baker, Malheur, Union, and Wallowa. The uninsurance rate is 24.6%, so almost a quarter of the population lacks health insurance.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think that the important question is how many of those people lack health care, and that's where the safety net clinics and the other kinds of things, and that's what I'm really interested in is, you know, we understand the insurance situation is getting worse, but I think it's important that we provide health care for those people somehow, you know, through the various clinics or working with hospitals and other providers.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I think it is much tougher to get at those numbers, because those are experiential, and you know, you have to really survey people to find out. But I believe this population survey may hold some of that data for us, and there were some profiles in the paper this morning of people who didn't have health insurance, and there were an even larger number who at some point during the last 2 years had not been insured. In very small communities, I know that the providers there make every attempt to see everyone that they can, but that ends up being a real strain on the hospitals and the clinics in rural areas. This slide looks at health status, and it looks at what we sort of euphemistically call unintentional injuries, and what that really means is accidents. I don't know why we can't just make one word out of it instead of two. But these are primarily motor vehicle accidents and occupational accidents, and this is a pretty astonishing piece of data, because it shows you that this is the rate per 100,000 population, and these are death rates, not just injury rates. And they're much higher in frontier counties, and then they are somewhat lower in urban counties than they are in the mixed urban and rural, and a little bit lower than that, or in the rural counties. We've tried to puzzle out why this is so. We think there are probably a couple of reasons for it. Part of it has to do with hazardous occupations and resource-based types of industries in rural parts of the state, farming, logging, mining, and those types of occupations. It also has something to do with the response rate of the emergency medical services in those parts of the state. I don't have very recent data for you on this. This data is about 5 years old, but it has not been, to my knowledge, resurveyed since then. But 5 years ago, if you called 911 in Multnomah County, the response rate was 8 minutes. And if you called 911 in the frontier counties of the state, the average response rate was 4.5 hours. And, you know, that has to do with the fact that most of the emergency medical services personnel in those areas are volunteers. They're carrying a pager or a radio or a cell phone with them, and they have to be mustered. They have to leave their jobs. They have to all come together. You know, it's a long process to respond to a 911 call in some parts of the state. So you want to drive carefully when you're in Malheur and Harney counties. This is another rather unique rural issue, in that tobacco-related deaths as a percentage of all deaths are significantly higher in frontier counties, for example, than they are in the urban parts of the state. One of the primary providers of health care in rural parts of the state is the Federally Certified Rural Health Clinic, and I do want to take a few minutes to talk with you about that. I know that Ed Patterson, who's going to follow me, will spend some time talking about that, and Bruce Goldberg will as well. But these are a particular category of provider that has to be located in a medically underserved or health professions shortage area. They provide outpatient primary care services. This can also be a physician's office. It does not have to be a private nonprofit provider. They do have to utilize a nurse practitioner or a PA at least half the time, and they receive cost-based Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement as an acknowledgement that they are located in an area that, number one, is underserved, and number two, has a higher proportion of Medicare and Medicaid patients, the payers for which, of course, do not pay at the same rate that private pay patients do. Our office spends a lot of time working with rural health clinics around the state, and we recently surveyed them. We didn't just get on the phone and survey them. We sent a part of our field team out to speak with every rural health clinic, so we did get some interesting data out of that. Here's where the rural health clinics are in the state. It's the red dots that are rural health clinics. The others are federally qualified health centers, which is another category of clinic that I know Bruce is going to spend some time explaining to you. but they are, as you can see, well represented all over the state. There are 50 rural health clinics in Oregon. And I thought you might appreciate taking a look at what some of them look like. This is the Rural Health Clinic in Christmas Valley in Northlake County. I'm happy to report that they just received a grant to build a new clinic. And so they won't be in this structure for very long, but they have been in this mobile home for about 20 years. This is the clinic in Dexter, up in Linn County, Lakeside Clinic. And this is the clinic in Bonanza, down in Klamath County. When I'm talking about infrastructure being a little shaky, you can see what I'm talking about.
A couple questions.
Thank you, Chair. Do we know, or is there a significant turnover in terms of clinics closing versus the new ones opening? Is there a stability problem with clinics remaining open?
Mr. Chair, Rick, yes, there is. The clinic in Christmas Valley, for example, has a history of opening and closing many times over the last 20 years. Lately, they've been more stable in the last 2 or 3 years. They've been more stable than they ever have been before because they managed to pass a ballot measure giving them a health district. And so they do have a tax levy now that supports them. But even the ones with tax levies, like Asher Clinic up in Fossil, have had a very difficult time remaining open. They recently became a federally qualified health center, and so now they get some federal support, so I think they will be successful. But you really just have to go from clinic to clinic and try to do what you can for them. The clinic in Jordan Valley down in Malheur County just hangs on by its fingernails. They're open just a few days a week now, and we hope we can continue keeping them open.
Karen, what kind of longevity is this funding, does it have? Is it a funding cycle from the federal government for these clinics? Is it a three-year?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that it's a yearly grant and it's renewable. And so long as they perform fill out all their reports and perform in a satisfactory manner, I believe the grant is renewable, but I think Bruce would probably know more about that than I do. I do know of one federally qualified health center that was closed in Klamath County about 5 years ago, and that was primarily a managerial and administrative problem that they encountered. But the grant that they get is intended to cover the cost of the uninsured patients.
Okay. Now, I just want to be sure we're talking about the same thing. This is a new federally funded clinic that there are several around the state.
Yes.
In fact, there's one in Springfield, and Springfield qualifies because of its demographics. Now, I was told that would go away in 3 years, and then I was told that there was no sunset on that grant, and that means it will continue as long as, I guess, the feds, but they don't plan on ending it at any particular time.
Mr. Chair, so long as the federal appropriations continue to be made, I think that once it is a very competitive process to initially secure one of these grants.
Yeah.
But once you do secure the grant, so long as performance is up to their standards, I believe that it's fairly easy to renew it from year to year. But even the clinics that have grants struggle, particularly because of the growing numbers of uninsured patients. And I know Bruce is going to talk some more about that.
Good. Thank you.
For the rural health clinics, and this is a picture of the payers among their patients. It's rather atypical and not at all like what you would see in an urban physician's practice. For example, 22% of their patients are Medicaid, and 26% are Medicare. 18% are what we call self-pay, which really means they have no insurance and most likely have no means to pay, and only 34% of their patients have private insurance. The average rural health clinic has about 3,300 visits per year, and their average patient revenues are $282,000. Their operating expenses are $328,000, so we can see right away that we've got a deficit in it costs more to operate them than they receive in patient revenue. So the average operating margin is almost 14% negative. 70% report an overall negative operating margin, and 35% report a negative overall margin, which means that even with the grants that they get and the subsidies that they might receive as a tax levy, 35% are still negative. And part of the reason for this is that many of them are in very sparsely populated areas, and they simply don't generate enough patient revenue. Even if every patient in town came to see them, there wouldn't be enough revenue to pay their fixed operating expenses. And that's certainly the case in Jordan Valley. But the nearest source of health care is about 110 miles away. So if that clinic closed, everyone there would have to go a long ways to obtain their health care. Of course, that's an area that's mostly just scattered ranches and quite a lot of elderly population as well. The top concerns that the rural health clinics reported to our field staff is that they have insufficient operating revenue, as I mentioned, and low patient volume. They have a very difficult time recruiting and retaining providers. They have a lot of administrative burdens with very small staff to deal with it, particularly with Medicare billing, and they're seeing, as we might expect, rising numbers of uninsured patients. I also want to talk with you some about the rural hospitals in the state, and I think this is another map that probably didn't come through on your handout, but the hospitals in the state are spread pretty well geographically. We do have a few counties that don't have a hospital. Sherman, Gillam, and Wheeler counties don't have a hospital, and Columbia County doesn't have a hospital, although they are about to build a new hospital up in Columbia County, and that's quite an interesting story in and of itself. The blue hospitals that you're looking at, the ones that are in blue, the ones that are in red are taking part in a program called the Medicare Rural Hospital Flexibility Program. We shorten that and call it the Critical Access Hospital Program. That's a federal program that our office administers, and it provides for those hospitals cost-based Medicare reimbursement, and that's a huge help for them because they have large quantities of Medicare patients.
Now, before you leave that slide, our committee will meet in Newport at the Newport Hospital on February 4th.
Right.
I was looking at this map last night online, and I was also looking at all of the A, B, and C hospitals and trying to figure out the difference between them based on the description that they give, and it's very difficult to figure that out, and I won't ask you to do that right now.
It's confusing.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
But we will be in Newport, though, and visit that hospital on February 4th. And we will hold a committee hearing there.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. I'm pleased. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, the A and B, just very shortly, okay. The ABC categorization is a state categorization,
yeah.
And then the critical access hospital is a federal categorization.
Oh, okay.
So you can be an A or a B hospital and be a critical access hospital at the same time, and it is very confusing.
Okay. Thank you.
I thought you might want to take a look at some of the rural hospitals as well as the rural clinics. So I brought this picture, which you can tell by the car there that this is not a recent picture. But this at one time was the hospital in Hermiston. And we were fortunate. The Hospital Association has been collecting these pictures over the years. And many of the hospitals during this era, they just looked like someone's family home. You know, a lot has happened since then, and this is what the hospital in Hermiston looks like now. And it is actually a very successful hospital and provides very high-quality care for the people in Hermiston. This is the current hospital in Heppner, which unfortunately doesn't look a whole lot different from the first picture that I showed you. It is one of the smallest hospital in the state.
We visited that a few years ago.
I remember. It only has 12 beds.
Yeah.
It's a very small hospital. And this is the hospital in Burns. It probably looks just about like that right now. And they are also preparing to build a new hospital in Burns. The occupancy rate of Oregon hospitals, data, a very good report from the Office of Health Policy and Research, pointed out that the occupancy rate in Oregon hospitals has increased, and in fact, in urban areas, it is 71%. The first time I put this slide together a couple of years ago, it was down around 58-59%. But as you can see in the frontier hospitals, it's still very low. It's only 25.7%, and difficult to cover their fixed costs, particularly with the percent of Medicare patients that they have. And of course, Medicare doesn't pay as well as commercial carriers. And if you combine Medicare and Medicaid together, you have almost 60% of your patients in the rural hospitals in those categories. And that has a pretty consistent linear relationship with the rurality of the area. So you get down to urban areas, and it's down to 47.3%. What happens as a result of this is that the average frontier hospital has a negative operating margin, and the average rural hospital has barely a positive operating margin. So that directly reflects on their financial success. And the final issue I want to talk with you about is the numbers of providers in rural areas. This is this figure represents the ratio of physicians to population. And in the frontier counties, it's pretty close to 1,400 people for every physician. And in Portland, if you're in a group of 200 people, one of them is likely to be a physician because that's the ratio in Portland. Of course, in all fairness, they serve a larger population than just Portland residents because of the tertiary hospitals in Portland. And in fact, OHSU, about 40% of the patients at OHSU come from outside the Portland metro area. I thought it'd be fair to show you one rural physician since I was showing you clinics and hospitals. And this is this print was taken off of the OPB rural doctor special that they put on last year. I don't know how many of you saw that, but this physician comes out of Burns. He rides in a mobile van around Harney County, and he's actually retired, but he still practices out of this mobile van a few days a week. The Shep Center from the University of North Carolina published a report on rural physicians a few years ago and concluded that non-metro physicians work longer hours and earn less than their metro counterparts. That just confirmed what we intuitively already knew. That also non-metro physicians get a higher percentage of their revenue from Medicaid and Medicare than their metro counterparts, and that they are more productive. And of course, they have to be more productive because there are fewer of them. So I know there's at least one rural physician sitting in the audience behind me, Dr. Chuck Hoffman from Baker City, and he could confirm that for you, I'm sure. A summary of those issues is that the rural parts of the state have unfavorable demographics, unfavorable health status measures. There are issues of workforce, fragile infrastructure, and diminishing resources to meet the needs in rural parts of the state. I don't want to make this all doom and gloom, so I want to talk with you a bit about some of our success stories. The legislature has supported the State Office of Rural Health, and we have been around for about 25 years. We have a staff of 12 people, three of whom are in the field continually, traveled about 60,000 miles last year, traveling to Oregon communities, giving them technical assistance. We have an Area Health Education Centers program, which started out as a federal program and is now being supported almost entirely by the state. The legislature passed a tax credit program for rural practitioners in 1989, and every rural practitioner, qualifying rural practitioner, gets a $5,000 personal income tax credit through the state of Oregon. In 2003, we added a subsidy for malpractice insurance, and that is just a three-year program. First year was last year to help subsidize the rising malpractice insurance premiums for rural physicians and make sure that services continued to be offered, particularly obstetrical services. type A and type B and critical access hospitals, some of whom, as we said earlier, are the same hospitals, get cost-based Medicaid reimbursement in the state of Oregon. That started in 1987 and was a very unique program at the time. Since then, other states have added that benefit for rural hospitals. And we have had in the past some funds for rural emergency medical services. Our office provides technical consultation to rural communities. We assist them to recruit and retain healthcare practitioners. We support the training and education of healthcare practitioners for rural practice settings. And we're also fortunate to participate in policy development. We use the state funds that we receive as a leverage to secure federal funds. Currently, 67% of the monies that come to the Office of Rural Health are federal monies. In 1990, when I began this job, we didn't have any federal money at all. So that has changed significantly. And we do administer many state and federal programs. This is a map that shows you how we have used some money that was appropriated to us from the state in 1999. This fund was active in 1999, in 2001, and unfortunately in 2003, we lost funding for this program. I'm sorry about the smallness of this map, but this was the Rural EMS Enhancement Account that was funded through the Unitary Assessment Fund. And we were able to give grants to rural communities primarily to pay for emergency medical services equipment. We gave away about $1.2 million, and we were asked for almost $6 million in the applications that we received. We were able to buy 12 ambulances, 79 defibrillators. We bought ventilators, radios, pagers, those jaws of life extrication tools. It was a very exciting program for us, and we passed all of that money through. We didn't take any administrative costs out of those funds. Those funds also went to the area health education centers to provide training for rural EMTs and first responders, and they were able to train about 1,500 people, most of whom were volunteers and could not afford to obtain that training out of their own pocket or take the time from work to go and receive that training. And of course that funding is also gone. I did want to talk with you a little bit about the area health education centers, because they have grown and developed sort of in parallel to the Office of Rural Health, and this program is also part of the OHSU Center for Rural Health. We have four centers statewide in four corners of the state. Those are private nonprofit organizations that are governed by local boards but have a relationship to OHSU. They place and support healthcare students in rural clinical rotations to assure that there'll be a future workforce for the rural communities. And they organize and coordinate training opportunities for rural providers, continuing education primarily for recruitment and retention. They also work on what they call the pipeline. And so they start back with students who are in middle school and high school to try to encourage them to pursue a career in healthcare, so that they have a sort of a grow-your-own philosophy, which is certainly the most successful way to recruit and retain a rural practitioner, is to have someone grow up in that community and return to that community. Now, I'm going to tell you about the bad news. The bad news is that the tax credit hasn't changed in 15 years, and, of course, $5,000 seemed like more money 15 years ago than it does now. As Dr. Hoffman can tell you, the following year you do have to declare that $5,000 on your state income tax as income, so you get taxed on it. We are about to experience a physician shortage statewide, not just in rural areas, but also in urban parts of the state. And so the rural areas that now have to compete with urban locations that can offer more money, better working conditions, they're going to have to compete with those areas to recruit and retain physicians. As I discussed with Chair Morissette, the OHSU AHEC funding has been cut 40% in the governor's budget. The statewide, the part of our budget that covers our statewide programs has experienced substantial reductions in the governor's budget. And the EMS funds were eliminated in 2003. A ruling from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services is also threatening the cost reimbursement for rural hospitals for Medicaid and Medicare. And we are negotiating with CMS as we speak, and I know that our state OMAP office is very committed to getting this issue resolved. What is at stake? Better health care means better quality of life for all. That's the obvious issue. And improved quality of life attracts businesses and people to a community. Healthcare accounts for 10 to 15% of rural economies, and in many rural communities, it is the first or second largest employer. The Oklahoma State University did some very detailed studies about 3 or 4 years ago talking about the actual value of physicians and hospitals to their communities. And what they found was that each physician in a community generates 17 jobs. And each physician has $343,000 in direct economic impact to the community each year, and $610,000 in indirect economic impact, for a total impact of almost $1 million per physician per year, in addition to the 17 jobs that are generated. Each hospital job in a community generates 2.25 additional jobs to the community, and the hospital revenues are returned to the community by a factor of 1.5. In Oregon, Oregon's rural hospitals have little more than 7,000 employees, so they're creating 16,740 new jobs for rural communities, and a total impact of about 24,000 jobs. $821 million in revenues for our rural hospitals times 1.5 means $1.2 billion for rural communities from our rural hospitals. And I thought as I conclude that you might want to be reminded of what rural Oregon looks like, although I'm sure all of you have been there. This is the road between LeGrand and Pendleton. It's a nice straight road. It probably doesn't look this nice right as we're speaking, however. This is a lovely view of Mount Hood. Oregon's rural communities are very diverse. Here is a nice view of the Oregon coast, and this is another Mount Hood highway picture. So this is some of what we have at stake. Most of us depend upon, even those of us who live in urban parts of the state, depend upon rural Oregon for much of our recreation. So I think that it's important to urban legislators as well as rural legislators to keep rural Oregon healthy.
Good. Thank you. Good questions? I'd like to get into the long-term care issue, but I don't know that we need to do it right now. They're related, and we visited all the 14 facilities that we visited included, I think, every kind, including the nursing homes, which sometimes are connected with the hospitals. And I know there are some problems with funding of adult foster homes and assisted living and so on.
Senator Moore said, I wish I could tell you more. I've begun to do some research into long-term care and to gather information from you. For you, we do primarily deal in primary care and hospital care in our office, but certainly it's a related issue. And we do know that some of the rural hospitals that have nursing homes as a part of their operation have had to close those nursing homes because of reimbursement issues. So and when you close a nursing home in Bandon, There isn't another nursing home for people to go to, so or in Heppner either, and people have to go to Pendleton too, and people who want to visit their family members in the nursing home have to make a long drive. So it's a critical issue, certainly, for rural Oregonians, and I've been working with Jim Carlson to gather some additional
information. Well, that's an area that we will, a separate issue, well, it's not separate, but it's a related issue, but we'll deal with it at a separate time, and so maybe we'll see you again. But we will work together on this issue during this session, because I want to make your last year your most productive.
Thank you, Senator. Make it a memorable one.
A memorable year.
Yes, Rick.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Karen, you brought up the slide earlier of the medical malpractice. Is that the House Bill 3630 from 203?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Is there any data available on what kind of hopefully positive impact that's had on rural physicians? Do we know yet?
You know, I think it's a little too early to tell. I think some physicians are not included in this bill. If those who work for a health system, if the health system pays their malpractice on their behalf, they're not included. I think it's probably been a pretty powerful retention tool for some physicians. Some of them had already quit doing OB and found that they were having a difficult time reestablishing their OB practice because there's only one insurer in the state now who underwrites OB practice. And so we were able to kind of change some people around and get a new insurer for them in John Day, for example, where we thought that they were going to lose OB coverage altogether. But certainly I think it has had some beneficial effect. I don't think it's solved the problem. It's just sort of put a Band-Aid on the problem for the time being. You know, we'll take whatever we can get.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ed Patterson, would you like to come up, please? We'll just go ahead and leave that up there for a while.
It's nice to look at.
No, you can take it down. We don't want Ed to get too comfortable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ed Patterson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Rural Health Association. I want to thank you for the invitation to present some information regarding our legislative agenda today. I do appreciate that chance. I think Rick passed out a paper called The Rural Health Disparities and Rural Health Safety Net. Looks something like this. And that lists a number of... let me say before I go into this, my mission, I believe, is twofold. Basically, to educate the committee on the differences between urban, rural, and rural health issues. And this is a study that was done back in 2001 by the National Center for Health Statistics. And I think Karen quoted some of these comments in her testimony. As an example, death rates from unintentional injuries increased greatly as counties become less urban. Death rates for motor vehicle-related injuries in most rural counties are over twice as high as the rates in central counties and large metro areas. Rural counties are less likely to have employer-provided health insurance coverage and tend to be poorer. Rural populations is typically more elderly, have lower socioeconomic and educational status, and there are cultural and social differences. And the last one down there, I did have to put that in bold when I had it typed. There was a lack of recognition and priority by legislators for rural health concerns. And I think that's understandable. Most legislators are from more urban areas, and I think a role that my association can play is to try to bring forth information to show you that there are substantial differences between rural health and urban health. And not to create any diversity between the two, but there are distinct differences, and our belief is that there should be what would be called a rural health safety net. Not a safety net like all the clinics in the state safety net, but a distinct rural health safety net. And it has to be distinctive because rural issues are substantially different than the urban issues. Our association was formed back in 1992 for that very reason. And as you can see in the second page there, where it talks about our association, we came together and founded this group. It consists of about 500 individual members who pay dues annually, 33 organizational members, 34 rural health clinics, and there's about 20 of the organizational members that are rural hospitals themselves. And there are 8 founding members representing some very influential health organizations: the Oregon Nurses Association, the Area Health Education Center, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, the Oregon Primary Care Association, the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and of course the Office of Rural Health. We are a volunteer organization, and I am here not to lobby but to educate, because we're a 501c3 organization. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to present to you our proposed policy decision for creating and sustaining the rural health safety net. Basically, I'm trying not to duplicate some of the information that Karen gave you, and I know that Dr. Goldberg will be presenting lots of information about health clinics. But it is our belief there are three major pieces of rural health. One is the pre-hospital care aspect, the emergency medical services, EMT programs that provide pre-hospital care. They're out there and do all kinds of things, from getting on a horseback to go up in the mountains and rescue people that have broken legs. Most of these are all volunteer operated. It's getting to the point where it's even difficult to recruit the volunteers to run EMS programs. As Karen alluded to, we did have funds that went to the AHACs to provide free education to these volunteers, and now they had to go back to paying for their own emergency medical training. And there are people who are working two jobs just to make a living in rural areas, and I am told from the AHAC over in LaGrande that they're having a difficult time in getting people to train and operate on a volunteer basis.
Now, you just violated one of our rules is on acronyms, so would you please tell us what AHAC is? You don't have to pay a fine this time.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you for that. AHAC stands for Area Health Education Centers. Okay. And these are the four organizations that Karen alluded to that are on all four corners of the state providing educational training. Okay. EMS is Emergency Medical Services. I might have used that one too.
Well, that's okay. We good. Thank you.
Well, play to watch that. Save me money. Second is the alternative care and remote
501c3, so we don't charge 501c3.
All about pocket change. Second priority is the alternative care in the remote areas, and these are the rural health clinics. As you can see, I have listed out there. These are absolutely necessary in the rural parts of the state. The problem is that some of them are staffed by a single nurse practitioner or a single physician assistant, and some of them are operating just part-time. They don't have any clerical staff to speak of. Some of them have volunteer clerical staff to operate their clinics, like in Christmas Valley and Halfway, Oregon, and places like that. But and there's no hospitals there. If we didn't have these clinics operating, there would be no health care for those small communities and people who live in those rural areas. We have on two occasions attempted to get some funding for these rural health clinics. You'll recall that, you may recall, the last session, I think out of the Senate, Human Resources Committee passed a rural health clinic bill and had funding in the bill. The bill went to Ways and Means Committee and never saw the light of day again. In the past, we have had monies in the 2001 session. We had $3 million that had been appropriated for clinics. And for some reason, in the last week of the legislature, it was down in Ways and Means, and the money disappeared and went to some other legislative priority. And that seems to happen more often than not. And I think it's because that there is not a clear understanding about why or what the importance of a sustaining rural health safety net is. These components are absolutely necessary. The third one, of course, is hospital care. These rural hospitals are 32 in the state, and they are absolutely the cornerstone of providing health care in these communities. It was mentioned about the large number of uninsured in the four counties over in eastern Oregon. Each one of those counties only has a single hospital, and they're all small, under 50-bed type hospitals. If you didn't have those hospitals, you wouldn't be able to recruit the health professionals you need for those populations. There are very few doctors that are going to come to a community and set up a practice if you can't admit patients to a hospital, so you wouldn't be able to recruit them. There are a lot of well-paying jobs of medical specialists, technologists, and those kinds of things that are recruited to communities because of hospitals, so they're economically important. But more importantly, from a healthcare standpoint, these hospitals need to survive in the locations they're at, or we're going to have bigger rural health problems than we have now. The first cost-based reimbursement legislation that was passed in 1987, and that's when we created these definitions of Type A and Type B hospitals. And the legislature appropriated funds for Type A hospitals. At the time, there was only eight hospitals that were in that classification. Type A hospital is a hospital that has less than 50 beds, and it's more than 30 miles from the next nearest hospital. A Type B hospital has less than 50 beds, but can be closer than the 30-mile designation. Cost-based reimbursement is not a panacea. Cost-based reimbursement means that the top Medicaid payments for taking care of Medicaid patients, the hospital receives its Medicare established cost, which is, it probably covers the overhead, but that's about all. And it was substantially more than what Medicaid was reimbursing back in 87. In 89, we brought the Type B hospitals into the program, so that all the rural hospitals in the state were receiving cost-based reimbursement. Since 1989, there has been attempts to do away with all or part of the cost-based reimbursement for rural hospitals. There have been legislative proposals. There have been budgetary proposals that came out of governor's budgets. And this session, there is an LC draft of a proposal that would basically threaten those hospitals. I'm told that it may not come to fruition or be developed into a bill. But I'm concerned that in the last week or two of a session, like these things tend to happen, you lose your ENS funding, you lose your critical area health link funding. The same thing could happen this time, so I want to make the county aware of that. My hope is that these issues can be addressed by this committee.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We're doing something different this time as far as the substance committees and the budget committees, and Senator Miles Hendrickson will be on the Senate subcommittee for health. So she will be looking at your budget, right?
Right.
Right. And she is a 110% supporter of these programs. But I think you raise a good point, and I think it's important to have people who serve on both committees. I'm on a different subcommittee dealing with a different issue, but we do have someone representing the two health committees that will be on the Ways and Means, who will really take the hard looks. And so I feel confident that we will be able to help the programs that you're talking about, or keep them from being eliminated or cut back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good. No, I think that's a good strategy.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
I have reviewed Dr. Goldberg's report that I think he distributed to all of you, so I know you haven't had a chance to look at it, but I extracted some information out of there, and with his permission, would like to share some information about the rural hospitals, again, to show the differences between the urban and the rural. And I've given him a copy of some of the things I'm going to be talking about, just in case I miss something. The next page is out of his study. And what I did is I cut and pasted, because the charts were located in different sections of the report. I wanted to present them to you all on one page so I can show you what the differences are. These are the median operating margins and total operating margins of Oregon DRG hospitals. In the top chart, DRG stands for, diagnostic related groups. Didn't want to use the synonym or the acronym. And it has evolved that hospitals in Oregon have been called a DRG hospital because these are the larger hospitals. They get paid under the diagnostic related group, get paid Medicare under that funding scheme. But the A and B hospitals are receiving the cost, so we refer to the small hospitals as Type A, Type B. Large hospitals are DRG. There are, at last count, 32 A and B hospitals and 28 large hospitals. These charts, I think, are very illuminating. You can see in the total, the dark line there is the total margin for the hospitals. It goes back 9 years. And just looking at the DRG hospitals, you can see that 9 years ago they had a margin, total margin, of 5.3%. And in 2003 they had a total margin of 5.2%. So they're pretty level. There's not a lot of volatility. They're relatively stable. Flat earnings, not exorbitant. Their patient revenue, which is the operating margin, was 4.6% margin and 3.5%, down just a little bit in 2003, but pretty steady around the 3 to 4% level. And if you get down to the type A hospitals in terms of their operating margins and total margins, you can see the wild fluctuations that the type A hospitals have. As an example, in 1995, their operating margin was minus 0.3%. And their operating margin in 2003 is minus 2.2%. The trend there is that it just keeps getting lower and lower, which signals, even though with cost-based reimbursement, those guys are going to have a tough time making it. A lot of the type A hospitals have other revenue that comes in. A lot of them have a tax base, property tax base. So you can see that their total margin is above the line, but most, except for 2 years, their operating margin was below the line, below the profitability line. And the trend is getting lower, which means they should be on the lookout. The type B hospitals, and one of the criticisms that I think you probably will hear when this discussion comes up, is that type Bs and probably should not have receiving cost-based reimbursement. But the reality is, if you look at those hospitals, they have had quite a bit of fluctuation. They have had an operating margin that's often close to the line. Back in 95, they had 3.2% operating margin. And in 2003, they had 2.1%. But on a couple of those years, they were down to 1% operating margin. And the total margin is trending exactly the same way as the margins were for the type A hospitals. The trend is the profitability of these hospitals keeps going down. I took this opportunity also took some hospital profiles out of Bruce's study that you folks have received. And I've got six hospital profiles, three of the larger hospitals in the state and three from the smaller hospitals in the state. And I just want to go over these for you. I think they are very illuminating in terms of the data. And Dr. Goldberg's office has written what I consider the best report I've ever seen come out of that office. Lots of data in there for making decisions. The first hospital I want to talk about is the Legacy Emanuel Hospital, which is a large metropolitan hospital, as you probably know. I'm going to cover just part of the information that is here for the hospital. I want to talk about payer mix. That circle graph on the lower right-hand corner is what I want to spend my time on, but I think it's interesting to look at this individual hospital and look at the operating margin and total margin for that one of the largest hospitals in the state. You can see how they have very little fluctuation. The operating margin and the total margin are pretty close together. Again, the margin of profit is not great. But look at the uncompensated care chart right below that. I think is also a very telling bit of information. Back in 1995, pre-Oregon Health Plan, it was 6.6% uncompensated care. And in 2003, it's 4.7%, and that trend was going down. I think that's a benefit of the Oregon Health Plan when it was in its heyday. The payer mix, though, is what I'd like to spend some time on each of these hospitals and compare the payer mix in terms of the large hospitals versus the rural hospitals. As you can see under the legacy payer mix, if you combine the Medicare and the Medicaid, 40% of their patient load came from government-paid patients. And the government reimbursement is not known for being very profitable. But I would say that in most cases it probably covers the overhead. But the mix for government patients was 40% for legacy. The self-pay patients was very small, 5%. As Karen alluded to, that means that probably those are charity cases for the most part. Not many people have funds to pay their hospital bills by cash. So that contributes to the charity care. But the important part that I want to stress is that the other or private pay patients was 56%. Well over half of their patients were private pay. And as you probably do know and may not know, that when you start lowering the reimbursement rate for Medicaid or Medicare, that cost of taking care of those government patients is shifted over to the paying population. So that hospital has at least a safety net of their own in terms of 56% patient of private pay patients. The next one is the OHSU, and of course, is a teaching hospital. And I won't spend any time on the operating margins or the uncompensated care, but I ask you to look again at the payer mix. If you combine the payer mix for OHSU, you'll have 43% are government patients in that institution, 6% are self-pay, and 51% are private pay. Again, the private pay number is really important. If it's over 50%, it's considered manageable. I took one of the smaller hospitals in the state, which is Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis. still a DRG hospital. If you look at their government patients, 31% Medicare, 10% Medicaid, 41% total government patients, but their private pay patients are 57% of their total revenue. Again, that's a comfort level for that hospital. If you look at the rurals, and I took three rural hospitals, I just arbitrarily selected North Lincoln Hospital and the Lebanon Hospital and the Lincoln City Hospital, because all three of those hospitals are part of the Good Samaritan system. They're owned and managed now by a Good Samaritan out of Corvallis. But if you look at the payer mix for those hospitals, and of course the uncompensated care is very high for that first hospital, North Lincoln, 6.7% uncompensated care compared to some of the larger hospitals' percentages. If you look at the payer mix, that hospital has 44% Medicare, 14% Medicaid, for 58% total of government-sponsored patients. And the thing that makes it scary is only 35% of its patients are private pay patients. So you can't shift the additional cost of 58% of your patients down to 35% of your patients for very long before something has to give. At the Lebanon Hospital, which is the next profile, that hospital has 67% government patients, very high Medicare patient load, 52%, over half their patients in Lebanon, with only 36% private pay, almost zero self-pay. Again, that's what creates some of the management problems that are reflected here in the operating margins on the left-hand side. And of course, they have 61% that are uncompensated care patients. And the last one, Pacific Communities Hospital in Newport, which is the one the committee will be visiting, Mr. Chair. That hospital has 56% government patients, 41 Medicare, 15 Medicaid, and only 38% private pay. To me, there are many more charts in the report from Dr. Goldberg, and there is a commonality among all the rural hospitals that basically vary very little from those profiles, and that's why there is justification in my mind for at least continuing the cost-based reimbursement. There is justification in my mind for operating rural health clinics because it keeps those patients out of the emergency room in the hospital, which are very expensive to care for there. And part of the whole scheme of creating a rural health safety net is those important aspects, the clinics, emergency medical services, and hospital care. It was mentioned that the newspaper, the Oregonian article this morning, that was also quite revealing, that the four counties over in eastern Oregon, Baker, Union, Lowell, and Malheur, only have, they're all fairly large counties, there's only one hospital in each one of those counties, and they have 24.6% uninsured, which is, as you indicated, Mr. Chair, that's not the whole story, but it's a good part of the story. A lot of those, when you have a fourth of your patients uninsured. As compared to statewide, there's only 17% uninsured in state. That's over 600,000 people, and 17% is not good. But in the Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas County, they reported there was 16.5%, a little less than state average in those three counties. So we have problems with the healthcare delivery system in the state, not only in just rural parts of the state, but also in the urban parts of the state. But the rurals, I think, are entitled to a specific legislative intent action, possibly a bill, to create a rural health safety net. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair? Could you... Has there been any comparison, or maybe I'm not sure how to word this? I want to address the hospital rates and provider rates. And have you done any surveys regarding the rates of a Type B hospital versus DRG hospital? OHSU.
Senator Mona Anderson, Mr. Chair, you're talking about the charges, the hospital charges?
Yes.
I think you should ask Dr. Goldberg that question. He may have done some work that way. I'm not aware of any studies that have done that.
Okay. But in this comparison, it would be nice to know what the... 36% came from private pay, and it would be nice to know what the charges were and where that money, you know, what the rates were. And I know a lot of this probably has to do with contracts between insurance companies and hospitals. I'm not sure. This is something we're going to get into, mm-hmm. at least in my committee, but I just wanted to know if part of your organization had gotten any information on that.
And I think there may be somebody from the hospital association here too, is that right? Since I testified, might ask whether they have done it or not. But I would only say from my experience is that the more sophisticated procedures are done by the larger hospitals, and they are the more expensive procedures. So it would be, in the years when I was a hospital administrator, I know small rural hospitals had quite a bit the lower charges because they didn't do the sophisticated medical procedures in there. And the more sophistication the hospital got and evolved as medical specialists, the more expenses were created, and they would have to adjust their rates. So I think it depends on the profile of that individual hospital. I don't know that you can make a conclusion whether there was higher or lower charges, or unnecessary charges, I should say, with any type of hospital unless you really looked at this. Dr. Goldberg's study has the top 10 DRGs for all of the hospitals, and you can just about, if you look at those, you can tell the kinds of services that they have, the most type of services they have. And even the larger hospitals have different mixes in terms of the type of DRGs that are more predominant. All that has to be calculated into the cost, the charges.
Well, it'd just be nice to know if a vaginal delivery was the same cost in a type B hospital as it would be at OHSU or at a DRG hospital. Those are the types of things that would be interesting.
Is it safe to say that as new expensive equipment is acquired, that is kind of spread out over the rates, everybody's rate? I mean, not everybody needs, well, I remember when the MRI came in, not everybody needs an MRI, but once you buy the machine, you have to amortize it over years and across the board. Is that the way it's done? So,
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question because I've said for many years now, having been involved in operating hospitals, is that I think the modernization of medical equipment is probably very cost-effective. Years ago, when we had cost controls in hospitals, people said, well, you can't have more than one MRI in the state of Oregon. And now we have who knows how many MRIs in the state. But MRIs were invented to resolve healthcare problems early. And with all the diagnostic equipment that there is now, my guess is that patients, while they may be paying more, are much healthier because of all this modernization of medical equipment. And I think they would be proven to be very cost-effective, and I think that's what hospitals look at, whether they're going to expend that kind of those funds or not.
Well, the question is, how are they paid for? Are they paid for solely by the people who use them, or are they paid for by setting a higher rate for everybody that goes to the hospital? That was my question.
It would be worthwhile, Mr. Chair, I think, if for me to bring in somebody from the Hospital Financial Management Association to talk about how those charges are evolved. I think there's a system that almost every hospital uses.
Yeah, we're just getting into the area now in medical practices where we're starting to identify procedures and drugs that we've used for years that are actually dangerous. And I understand that x-rays are come into that category, certain types of x-rays that you should not go in once a year and have an x-ray of whatever it is that, you know. And so there are some other questions that evolve as we come up with the new technology. And, you know, some of those popular drugs in the market are now declared to be unsafe, which is really, and I'm wondering if that will come, you know, pull true for some of the techniques as well. But anyway, good. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good.
Bruce, would you come up, please, and then we'll have Dr. Goldberg after, and then you can. Oh, you're a Bruce also.
Well, who did you want?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Bruce.
Welcome, Bruce.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Now,
for the record,
I'm
Bruce Bishop.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bruce, I'm sorry for interrupting. Are you sufficiently introduced? Would you like to do that over again because I was interrupting you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
I just wanted to say that when we took our trip to Eastern Oregon, both you and Ed Patterson were there, and we meaning the Joint Health Service Health Committees, House and Senate, I think it was in the interim and between 01 and 03 maybe. We did visit 14 sites, visited all kinds of facilities, and that is where I really, really became interested in the rural health care. I had to think about it a while and reflect on what we saw and some of the problems, but it's you were there, so you...
Yes, we were, Mr. Chair, and we appreciate your interest in rural health care issues from that experience and others. Thank you for the invitation to testify this afternoon on behalf of the Hospital Association. It's a personal privilege to follow Ms. Whitaker and Mr. Patterson, from whom I've learned a lot over the years. Rural hospital viability is a very high priority for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And what I want to do this afternoon is present to you a copy of a letter dated January 3rd of this year from Oregon's Medicaid Administrator, Barney Spate, to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, the Medicaid program, because Mr. Spate's letter probably expresses better than I can the challenge that Oregon faces in making sure that your state policy, that cost-based reimbursement for rural hospitals is appropriate, be sustained by the federal government. We learned last year that the federal government was challenging the basis on which Oregon was paying rural hospitals, and the withdrawal of cost-based reimbursement from rural hospitals would be devastating. We will see hospital closures if that policy is allowed to stand. And what Mr. Spate has done in this letter is outline for you very well, I think, both the policy of the state and the reasons why Oregon must continue to provide cost-based reimbursement for those rural hospitals. We're into a debate a little bit about the NITS of federal Medicaid policy and whether the way Oregon has administered its program is consistent with those federal policies. Oregon's hospitals, I think all of us want to make sure that we're complying with federal law, but we can't afford to throw this policy out because the consequences of doing so would result in rural communities losing health care services, losing the economic engines that they have that provide jobs, that provide a place to receive care. And many of the communities that Ms. Whitaker referred to and showed you pictures of would literally dry up and blow away. Oregon is doing everything, I think, that we can to sustain those rural hospitals. We have the policies in place, and we need to make sure that we can continue to carry them out consistently with federal law. I urge you to read Mr. Spate's letter because I think it is a good recitation of the policy and the technical issues, and I urge you to support policy and budget decisions that will assure that rural hospitals continue to be viable in their communities. I would be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. Bruce number two. Dr. Goldberg, welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, My name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and here today at the request of Senator Morissette to talk a little bit with you about the safety net. We've had actually some great presentations from Karen Whitaker, who really gave an overview of rural issues. Ed Patterson started to sort of narrow it down on the rural safety net, and you know, Bruce Bishop actually took it down, as he said, to a small policy, but a very important policy issue for rural communities. I'm going to bring us back up for the end of the day to the somewhere around the 100,000 foot level, and really use this as an introductory opportunity to really establish some vocabulary about some of the safety net issues. The safety net's more than just a rural issue. We have a statewide need for a healthcare safety net. As Senator Morissette pointed out, the rising numbers of uninsured, issues around shortages of providers, means that this isn't just an issue of insurance, it's an issue of access and how people can get access to basic healthcare. And indeed, Oregon's healthcare safety net provides access to basic primary care services. And so what I'd like to do today is give you an introduction into that. We have had a work group for the last year working on this. The National Governors Association actually awarded Oregon, one of four states, to provide some technical assistance to begin to look at healthcare safety net policies and to begin to develop some recommendations. And at the end of my presentation, I have some of those for you. I've also provided you with a notebook, which is a copy of that group's full report. And I think you have a copy of my presentation today. The issue is one of both access, capacity, and demand for services. Healthcare providers, as you saw from Karen Whitaker, are not distributed to match patient needs in all areas of the state. We have shortages of providers in some areas, with shortages of providers that care for low-income individuals. Healthcare provider capacity is inadequate in many parts of the state, and that inadequate capacity means that people don't get access to basic healthcare services. You'll see, actually, this doesn't come out great on paper, but we put together a look at ratios of primary care providers, both physicians, nurse practitioners, and physicians' assistants, to the population. This was actually a survey done from the Office of Health Systems Planning, really trying to get at, in communities, is there enough basic primary care capacity to provide people access to just the basic health care, access to a primary care visit where they can get basic primary care problems met, access to medication, prescriptions, diagnostic treatment, etc. And what you can see from that is that we actually do have tremendous disparities across the state, that counties such as Baker, Gillum, Morrow County, Wheeler County have really pretty profound shortages in the primary care to population ratios. And this has been really broken out two ways. It's broken out based on the ability of those communities to meet the needs of the entire population, those are the light bars, as well as the ability of those communities to meet the needs of their low-income populations. And the way this data was gathered was by actually surveying the providers in these communities and getting a sense of not just how many existed, but also getting a sense of the capacity that they had. What we've learned over the years is that actually just counting numbers isn't always the picture. There may be a physician, a nurse practitioner who works part-time. You can't count them as a full-time provider in a community if they're only seeing patients 2 days a week. Likewise, it really depends at the ability of those providers to meet the needs of that population. Are they seeing everybody in the community? What's their ability to take care of low-income individuals as well as other members of the community? So that really gives you a sense that we really don't have the proper capacity throughout the state. On the next page, you can see some of the health professional shortage areas in the state, and actually, I believe Karen Whitaker showed this as well. There are areas of the state that have been deemed health professional shortage areas. These are federal designations as areas that either because of their geographical mix, or particular types of patient indicators are shortage areas. For instance, there are many parts of urban areas that have a predominance of very low-income patients, and indeed those are health professional shortage areas, whereas an entire urban area may not be. Same thing for homeless, migrant, etc. Likewise, we have some designations in the state that really look at what areas are medically underserved, as well as both medically underserved areas and medically underserved populations. And the reason I bring those designations up, because these are the ways that actually communities are able to qualify for either federal or state programs to help establish safety net clinics, and we'll get into that in a second. Not only is there a capacity problem, but we have a demand problem as well. As you've seen, the numbers of uninsured are increasing. So we have increasing demand for healthcare safety net services. The uninsured, especially those with lower incomes, tend to rely on the healthcare safety net for access. As we see greater numbers of uninsured, we see that actually mainstream providers also are experiencing increases in the numbers of individuals who either are uninsured, have Medicaid, or have Medicare. And so the demand for healthcare safety net services is increasing around the state. So we have an issue of, number one, really spotty capacity to meet the needs of our populations around the state in terms of a healthcare safety net, and we have demand issues. We have rising demand for healthcare safety net services. So what is the healthcare safety net? And we spent a lot of time as a group. We had a lot of people around the table from rural health centers, federally qualified community health centers, and I'll get into that, homeless clinics, school-based clinics, hospitals, etc. These are all parts of what are the healthcare safety net. We've really agreed, and it's been a somewhat of a monumental step for the state to really have an agreed-upon definition for what the healthcare safety net is. I think that certainly we know that when funding's available, everybody wants to be part of the healthcare safety net. When funding is not available, it really doesn't matter. And definitions are important. And we tried to take a look at this outside of what would be a funding climate and look at the healthcare safety net as a community's response to meeting the needs of people who experience barriers that prevent them from having access to timely, affordable, and continuous healthcare services. Different communities, in essence, cobble together a healthcare safety net in very different ways. In some communities, rural health centers may be the cornerstone of what's the healthcare safety net in that community. In other communities, it may be hospitals and hospital emergency rooms that provide the cornerstone of that. There are school-based health centers in some communities and not in others. There are federally qualified community health centers in some communities and not in others. In essence, communities help working with the state and working with others to define what their healthcare safety net is in that community. It may not be adequate. Certainly we know around the state that it's not adequate. But we know that healthcare safety net patients often experience barriers to accessing services from healthcare providers due to either cultural, linguistic, or financial barriers to care. They can't afford to pay for care in certain facilities. Healthcare safety net patients tend to be uninsured, underserved. They tend to be either Medicaid or Medicare enrollees. And they tend to be parts of other vulnerable or special populations, homeless, migrant seasonal farm workers, healthcare safety net providers are providers who deliver services to persons experiencing barriers to accessing the services that they need. They include this whole array of providers that I've talked about. But there's a core group of healthcare safety net, and those are the core group that are adept at serving people regardless of their ability to pay, whose mission or mandate is to deliver services to persons who experience barriers to care, and who by definition of their practice serve a substantial share of Medicare and Medicaid enrollees. And I think this is an important point. Certainly, you know, any healthcare provider that provides services to vulnerable, uninsured Medicaid and Medicare patients are by definition a part of the safety net. The issue is that we have some of those providers and some of those clinics that do a substantial share of that. That's their mission. And indeed, those are the core safety net providers. The safety net providers really vary based on their mission, their target populations, and they get funded from a variety of places. And what I'd like to do now is talk to you about the services they provide quickly, the places they get funding, and then we'll go through what is the alphabet soup of the safety net. Healthcare safety net typically provides primary and preventive services. They do provide some specialty care on-site. For emergent and emergent care, they provide some of the ancillary services such as x-rays, lab tests, mental health services, and certainly an important part of the healthcare safety net is dental care as well. Dental issues are very important, and certainly we have a lot of dental care that's provided in safety net clinics. Funding sources are really diverse. Safety net clinics are funded through federal grants. They're funded through some enhanced Medicaid and Medicare payments, as you've heard, and I'll go into that a little bit more. They get some governmental grants. They get foundations and corporate support. They bill patients who have private and commercial insurance and get revenues in that way. And the core safety net providers charge patients on a sliding scale and do get some revenue based on that. So who are these clinics? And really, if you look at this page, you can see that the core of what are healthcare safety net providers in terms of clinics are federally qualified health centers, of which there are actually 142 individual clinics around the state. There are sort of 24 sponsoring organizations. So an organization like Clackamas County has a community health center, NFQHC, but they may have that at three sites. They may have a clinic in Oregon City, a clinic in Malala now, and a clinic in Sandy. Likewise, Multnomah County, I think, has over a dozen clinics within Multnomah County. There are 24 sponsoring organizations, but 142 individual clinics. There are, well, Karen told us 50 rural health clinics, and I probably believe her number better than my 51. There are 43 school-based health centers. There are Indian and tribal clinics. There are community clinics, and these are at the clinic side. And I think as you saw from both Ed as well as from Karen, we have rural hospitals that are, and hospitals that are part of the safety net. Hospitals clearly are an important part, providing access to people who don't have health insurance coverage. So federally qualified health centers, these are what's known as FQHCs. These are nonprofit public organizations that are indeed designated by the federal government. And as Senator Morissette pointed out, actually, these are not new. Federally qualified health centers have been around for close to 20 years now. The difference currently is that the federal government is investing much more in federally qualified community health centers. And the president has funded the community health centers to a much greater degree than have been funded in the past. So Oregon is beginning to and trying to take advantage of what is some federal funding to try and boost community health centers. These are located in medically underserved areas, or they serve a medically underserved population. So as you've heard, we have federally qualified health centers in rural communities. We have them in Multnomah County. We have them in Lane County and in Multnomah County. They serve, we have some that serve homeless populations, some that serve migrant and seasonal farm worker populations. They provide primary and preventive services. They serve everybody regardless of their ability to pay. So anybody who shows up to a federally qualified community health center will get seen. They have a sliding fee scale. They interestingly have a governing board that the majority of members must actually be users or patients of the facility themselves. So these are nonprofit. They have their own governing board, which must be 51% users of the facility. They're designated by the federal government, and they come in several different types. They come as community health centers, migrant health centers, healthcare for the homeless programs. Some of our school-based health centers are actually also federally qualified community health centers. And what that means is not just who they serve, but also how they get their funding. And federally qualified community health centers get their funding in a variety of ways. They get their funding, some get money from federal grants, which those federal grants help support the care of the uninsured. Federally qualified community health centers get cost-based Medicaid payments, so they're paid for the cost of delivering services to Medicaid payments. You saw the payer mix of hospitals, where hospitals often have, as well as physicians in communities, will manage their payer mix. They have commercial payers, where who tend to be the best part of the better paying piece of the payer community, Medicare and Medicaid. And obviously, to run a business as a doctor or a hospital is, they have to manage that payer mix. They have to rely on a certain amount of commercial business that as well as Medicare and Medicaid, as well as taking care of the uninsured. Most of the federally qualified community health centers in the state, they tend to have predominantly two payers. Medicaid is the number one payer, and number two are the uninsured. I believe that it's about 40 or 50% of the patients seen in federally qualified community health centers are indeed uninsured. And actually, they use their Medicaid reimbursement as their primary payer. Federally qualified health centers, so they get federal grants, they get enhanced Medicaid and Medicare payments. The physicians, nurse practitioners that provide services at these facilities are covered through federal tort claims, so they have some decreased overhead in terms of malpractice insurance, and they provide discounted drugs to individuals who are seen at these programs by being able to avail themselves of some very low-cost, federally priced prescription drugs, the same kind of pricing that the VA and prisons get for prescription drugs. So they not only they provide a tremendous benefit for patients that are seen there by being able to provide access to low-cost prescription drugs. Rural health clinics, I really won't get into because you've heard some of that from Karen as well as from Ed. These rural health clinics were established primarily to increase access to Medicaid and Medicare patients. And then I think that's a bit of what sort of separates the federally qualified community health centers from the rural health clinics, is that the federally qualified clinics get some federal dollars to help support their mission for caring for the uninsured, not just for Medicaid and Medicare. Rural health clinics certainly provide more than their share of care to the uninsured, but indeed it's federally qualified health centers that have that as an expanded mission. And you've got a map of those. School-based health centers are also part of what would be called the healthcare safety net. They provide comprehensive healthcare services in a school-based setting, really providing access to primary care services for Oregon school-aged youth. There are, I believe, upwards of 40 school-based health centers in the state, and we've got some maps of those in front of you. We have Indian and tribal clinics, which are really geared at improving the quality of life and health status of Native American people throughout the state, and through the delivery of culturally appropriate services to that population. Indian and tribal clinics provide primary and preventive services, dental and mental health, very similar to the array of services provided by federally qualified community health centers.
Yeah. Thank you. Bruce, is it true some of the Indian clinics also serve non-Native Americans in the same community? I think the Celeste clinic we once visited, so they serve others.
Chair Morissette, Mr. McCartney, yes, indeed. Indian and tribal clinics, based on who they are, where they're located, how they're funding, and how they're governed, serve diverse populations, although primarily are there to serve the needs of the Native communities that they provide services to. Some are funded through the federal government, through Indian Health Service, some from tribal governments out of tribal funds, and some are get funding from the array of payers for health care that you've heard about today. And then I think the last piece of the sort of healthcare safety net are what's called community clinics. These tend to be clinics in communities that rely heavily on volunteer providers. There are many communities around the state that have established such clinics that are sponsored by a local organization, a hospital, a group of concerned citizens in a community that put together, in essence, what are volunteer clinics. They rely very heavily on volunteer workforce. They often target a particular vulnerable population, such as uninsured, homeless, chronically mentally ill. These are not federally defined. They tend to not get funding from either the state or federal programs. They tend to really limit themselves and try and focus their involvement on caring for the uninsured. And there are some examples and some locations on the maps that I've provided. And then lastly, we have some workforce programs in the state that help try and bring in the additional workforce that we need to meet the needs of low-income vulnerable populations. The National Health Service Corps is a program whereby National Health Service Corps paid for my medical school. I'm very familiar with it. It's a federal program. The federal government will pay your tuition in medical school, and in return, individuals who get their tuition paid by the National Health Service Corps then serve in providing care in a medically underserved community for however many years the federal government supported their tuition. Great program, helps get people to go to medical school and helps actually then get those graduates into communities. And then the goal of that program is to hope that once actually individuals spend 2, 3, 4 years in a community, that actually they'll stay. And indeed, increasing numbers of National Health Service Corps graduates stay. I stayed twice the amount of time as my obligation was where I served, and they can be great programs. We have a Conrad program here in the state, J-1 visa program, which is a program by which international medical graduates who come and do some training in this state can stay on beyond their training and actually practice in the state. They get visa waivers to stay in this state for their training and then would have to go back to their countries of origin, but they're now trained as specialists, and through this program they're able to then stay and practice in health professional shortage areas. We have about 30 slots for Conrad program J-1 visa docs a year. The HERO program, Healthcare Experts for Rural Oregon, actually is run out of the Office of Rural Health. Karen Whitaker, this really assists rural communities in recruiting physicians. The Northwest Tribal Recruitment Program does the same thing for Native American communities. And then Karen also mentioned the AHEC programs, the Area Health Education Centers, which really help bring medical students to do training in rural communities, to help interest them and practicing in rural and underserved communities, and they help provide physician education, recruitment, work on retaining the health professional workforce in many of our rural communities. So with that as sort of a high-level overview of the healthcare safety net, let me just close with some of the recommendations from the working group that the governor put together to actually begin to develop some policy recommendations to strengthen the healthcare safety net. We had a committee. It actually included four legislators, Senator Carter and Senator Nelson, as well as Representatives Dalto and Representatives Hansen participated on the group, as well as a variety of experts and stakeholders from the Safety Net Committee, from the Safety Net community. The number one finding of this group was, I think as you're getting a sense of today, and as you heard from Karen Whitaker, is that we don't have a very complete picture of A, the needs of communities, and B, the capacity of communities to meet the needs, the healthcare needs of those communities. We have put together, in essence, a patchwork quilt in our state and in our communities of facilities that serve those needs. But from a statewide perspective, what we don't have is we're not collecting data in a uniform fashion. We don't know what some of the needs are of individual communities, and we don't have as good a picture of putting together what are some of the capacities of those communities. And we need to be able to establish that. And that was, I think, one of the frustrations of this group. Was we initially sat down to really look at, well, what's the need, what's the capacity, where are the gaps, and how do we fill them? It seemed like that would be a very easy task. We quickly found out that what the needs were and what the capacity was wasn't such an easy question, and that it varied by community to community, and that we needed to have a better statewide picture of what that was so that we could provide resources to those communities that had the greatest need. That's, I think, an appropriate way to utilize resources. The work group came up with 9 recommendations. One was to establish a healthcare safety net advisory council to begin to sort of provide some oversight to these issues and to begin to assure that we moved in the right direction. To revise Oregon Statute 442 to indicate the importance of the safety net. You noticed in Ed Patterson's testimony he provided you with the statute around rural hospitals. This group felt that actually the we should do a similar thing for the healthcare safety net, to one, indicate its importance in the state, and to try and call attention of this to policymakers. We need to centralize healthcare safety net data collection and reporting so that we can provide you as a group a sense of where the need is. I mean, the hospital report our office put together is enabled by the fact that we can collect data in a uniform manner from all hospitals in the state, and that actually provides us with a great picture of what's going on around hospitals, but that's just one piece of what the safety net is, and we need to do that for the rest of the safety net community. We need to develop a plan to stabilize resources devoted to safety net services, assure that Oregon takes advantage of opportunities to leverage federal dollars to help support the safety net clinics, develop and implement a plan to support community innovations that improve access to health care. This really gets at the fact that, much as Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. Well, all health care safety nets are local. And we as a state need to really help and encourage and invest in local community innovation. It can't be one-size-fit-all solution. Different communities are going to want different approaches. And we need to, as a state, help support community innovation instead of really bringing everybody into looking exactly the same way. We need to improve the integration of primary health care and behavioral health care. It's an important issue. I think what we've all seen is that, you know, mental health care is a huge issue in this state, and I know that the legislature and this committee and Senator Mona Sanderson's committee are going to be addressing a lot of the issues around mental health. We certainly know that many people who suffer from mental illness actually are uninsured, indigent by nature of the fact that they have a disabling problem, and that safety net clinics and the healthcare safety net provides a lot of services to individuals who have mental illness. And it's important that we do that in a way where we can integrate mental health care into safety net clinics so we can provide the right care at the right place in an economical and manner in which promotes access to care. And then lastly, one of the recommendations, which I think was one of the most interesting of this group, was to develop and pilot a basic benefit package for uninsured pregnant women, children, and those most in need of medical care in the state. And the idea around this was the fact that we have Medicaid policy in the state, which is driven from a federal perspective, primarily based on one's income and is based on poverty level. And what this group is looking to do, and I think is an important direction, is to begin to direct our policy not just based on poverty, but also based on not just financial need, but also based on medical need. How are we certain that actually we get care to people who have mental illness, who have a real medical condition? How can when we look at why people show up in emergency rooms and have uncompensated care, these are often individuals with chronic illness who have asthma, diabetes, HIV disease, who have huge medical need, and yet if they don't have insurance, they are often going without care. We need to look at how we can get those individuals primary and preventive care so that they don't end up in hospital emergency rooms and in elsewhere. So the idea about this was to base eligibility on both medical condition as well as based on financial need, to focus Medicaid resources on controlling health care costs that are unavoidable to a community. You know, we can provide basic medicines to people with asthma and prevent them from ending up at a high cost stay in a hospital. That's what we should be doing. Focus on putting our resources towards preventing what are avoidable health care costs, reducing emergency room visits and unnecessary hospitalizations, actually improving the health of the population by providing a diabetic with the medication they need to help control their diabetes, we can actually improve those individuals' health, help them live longer, and actually document our return on investment to look at how, if we begin to put dollars into primary and preventive services, target the needs at the individuals, the communities who need it the most, and if we can start to get smart about this and really look at what's the need, what are communities' needs, what are individuals' needs, both from a healthcare need as well as from a financial need, and begin to put all of that together, that we can perhaps as a state begin to do a better job at doing that. I mean, in essence, this was some of what was talked about 10 years ago around the Oregon Health Plan in terms of creating a, you know, a prioritized list of services. This isn't quite the same thing, but it really is looking at how do we target our resources at those communities, at those individuals, at those healthcare problems that are most in need. And if we can get smart about that, we can help make our resources go a little further. And so this group really is trying to push this forward and say we need to develop and pilot a basic plan to do that. And that's going to mean actually working with our federal partners. And the report lays out and recommends that we actually begin work on that yesterday. So with that, let me stop and take any last questions you might have.
I think the key is the very last item that you listed, and that is documenting the success, because, you know, it's hard to argue for prevention programs because we do that in school. You know, let's start preschool because we can prevent all these things. Documenting them is a different problem, but it's important to document. How do you do that?
Right. I think one of the issues, Jamar said, is we actually, as we do some of these things and as we make policy, we have to be mindful in not just putting resources to something, but also certainly specifying and providing the ability of the state to evaluate the effectiveness of some of that. And I think that we've got a long history of making policy and funding policy and then often finding out about the effects of it or being unable to measure the effects of it. And if I think we're mind, these aren't big investments, but I think we can begin to do that just by coordinating some of the efforts that currently exist in the state to do that.
This is one area where anecdotal documentation is important because you can cite cases where this person would be dead if they didn't have these services, so I think that's very important. We're struggling with the our program-based budgeting in terms of the difference between quality and quantity. It's easy to say we're going to do more of something, but does that mean we're doing better? So I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. Thank you.
Very good report.
Yeah. And you're right on time.
That's what I wanted to do.
Cool.
Okay.
Good. Thank
I'm
you.
Done.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Karen. Thanks, Ed. Okay. We're adjourned.
Thank you.